Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is A.S. Byatt, whose latest novel is The Children's Book, now out in trade paperback. Earlier books include The Little Black Book of Stories, Whistling Woman, Angels and Insects, Possession. There are 15 books of fiction, 7 books of essays, books that are edited by A.S. Byatt. When were you made a dame?
I think it was 1990. It was actually the year of Possession, but being made a dame was before Possession came out. I think it was for services to literature and sitting on committees and things like that.
This book is a tapestry of events and people that take us from about 1895 up to World War I, or the end of World War I. And it follows a group, large group of individuals and the societal and artistic currents of England in particular, and also Europe during the late Victorian and the Edwardian into, I guess, the period of King George. What brought you to examine in such depth in a novel that particular period?
It was a period I'd always avoided as a student. I could have studied it at Cambridge as a special period, and I avoided it because I thought I didn't like the authors of the period. I'm not very interested in H.G. Wells or Bernard Shaw, I thought. And I came to it, really, because it's the period of the very great children's writing, the period when people like Kipling, E. Nesbitt, Kenneth Graham, and James Barrie were writing, you know, works of literature which were works for children. And I got very interested in all that. And somehow it spread out because some of them were very interested in politics. It spread out into the whole world without me quite realizing it.
In terms of what we've got here, we have several families that interact with one another, but the family that we begin with is the Wellwood family, in particular a fictional character named Olive Wellwood, who writes the children's book. So that would have been the starting point, Olive.
Yes, it would. It was Olive, and she had to have a very large number of children because I realized that in that period there were families of 7, 8, 11, 12 children. And it was also the time when adults started speaking to children as though they were people and not segregating them in quite the same way. And I realized that these human beings were different from any before them or after them, because after them there came contraception and families became smaller. And I was interested in the group life of these children, who both had a separate life running about as a group without any adults, and a life in which they did interact with the adults. So that was how it got to be. It had to be somehow a novel with a very large cast, which was difficult to control.
As I was reading the book, and certainly afterward, and talking with people who, interestingly enough, were simultaneously reading the book over the course of the past couple of weeks, a lot of different themes began to emerge. But the question is, for you, A.S. Byatt, as the writer, were any of those themes necessarily present when you sat down and began the book, or did they just simply emerge kind of organically?
Most of them emerged organically. I spend a very long time when I'm writing a book not writing anything. I keep very large notebooks, and I work out all sorts of things in a provisional way in manuscript in the big notebooks, so that when I began writing, I had some idea of how many different groups of characters and themes there were. I thought for a long time about children and children's books. And E. Nesbitt, who is not the original of Olive, but bits of whose life are replicated in Olive's life. E. Nesbitt was a founding member of the Fabian Society, which is the sort of left-wing, thoughtful, cautious, innovative part of British politics. I was interested in this. I mean, why would you be a children's writer and founding member of a political group of this kind? So I started researching the Fabians, and that sort of moved me out. And then I hit quite quickly the terrible problem of poverty and people trying to cure poverty in that period. It was partly because I never had been interested. I became very interested. It was a period I'd skipped. I knew a lot about the high Victorians just before it, and I knew a lot about the moderns, sort of from the 1930s on, but that piece I didn't know. So I became quite obsessed with finding out everything.
It seems that that was a period where we saw the emergence. I mean, it had been there in Dickens, obviously, but we saw the emergence almost of an idealistic movement that had not existed before.
Absolutely. And these people were not upper-class do-gooders, though there were a lot of those. They were the middle classes who had done a lot of thinking. There were settlements in the East End of London where the poor were. People actually built wonderful educational settlements, and idealistic young men went and lived there, and they taught classes on Shakespeare, and they taught classes on ancient art, on the Greeks. They produced plays, and the working people came in and had books and listened, and the very same people started thinking about how to reform the lives of people. It was members of the Fabian Society who thought up the idea of the old age pension. It was members of the Fabian Society who had the first idea that you could perhaps pay unemployment benefit, because I read some terrible things about what happened to you if you were a carpenter and you strained your back. You descended into absolute poverty and lost your house, and your wife had to go on the streets in a matter of weeks. They wrote about that. They brought all that to the attention of the general public. They were very admirable people, but like all very admirable people, they were quite self-righteous.
This large cast, let's start by talking about some of the progenitors of these individuals. So we have Olive, kind of came out of Nesbitt a little bit. I mean, she does not appear in the book, but Barry does, and Kenneth Graham, I had no idea that he was a banker.
Yes, he was the secretary of the Bank of England, of the old lady of Threadneedle Street. I was absolutely bowled over. I read a very good biography of him. And there really was a moment when a man with a pistol broke into the office of Kenneth Graham and said he was going to kill him because of what the bank was doing to the economy. And Kenneth Graham sort of had to restrain him. And they danced around the desk, and somebody finally came in and removed him. And then there were all sorts of wonderful stories about how the bank clerks used to go out and buy great big carcasses of beef in the Smithfield Market and cut them up in the offices of the bank and take pieces home for the weekend to cook, which Kenneth Graham used to tell. I think they asked him to leave the bank after he wrote The Wind in the Willows, because they said he was less and less involved in the bank and more involved in making money by writing children's books.
Which, of course, will bring in the area of children and the title of the children's book, but I want to get back to some of the progenitors. So you have Olive, you have Humphrey and Basil Wellwood. Basil works in a bank, and Humphrey, I'm not sure what Humphrey does, come to think of it, he gives speeches.
Well, Humphrey was working in the bank. His brother had got him a job. He was working in a rather clerk-like capacity in his brother's bank, which was in fact a German bank. And then he had a quarrel with his brother because he was doing anonymous journalism. He was reporting on city scandals anonymously, and his brother found it out. He found out that this anonymous person called the March Hare was actually his brother. They had a terrible row.
Is that based on anybody?
No, not really. There's a most wonderful history in three volumes of the City of London, which all sorts of things are in, and there were several of these dangerous journalists.
The book opens up when we see their son Tom and Julian Kane, who is the son of the man running the Victoria and Albert Museum, are in the basement and stumble across a boy named Philip, who's a very talented potter, as it turns out. The entire Julian Kane story in the museum is the father of Julian based on somebody, and is Julian, who becomes a poet, based on anyone?
No, they aren't. I invented them. I invented Prosper Kane. I invented his job, too. He's the special keeper of precious metals. What Prosper Kane has, which was true of the South Kensington Museum, which became the Victoria and Albert, is that he's a military man, and the whole of the museum was at that point run by military men. There was sort of a barracks in the garden, and all the sort of attendants were old soldiers and sappers and things. And a large amount of the committee consisted of various colonels and majors and generals. And they obviously ran it extremely well in most ways, though they got into terrible quarrels with the art historians. And I got very attached to my military man. When I invented him, I had one idea of how he was going to be rather upright and severe, and a connoisseur of antiques, but not necessarily very nice. And he turned out as I wrote the book, to be a very good man, I think.
The other major characters, well, there are so many, but then we have Benedict Flood, the potter, and Philip, who becomes his apprentice and perhaps a greater artist after that. Was Flood based on someone?
Flood has certain unpleasant sexual habits, which are based on Eric Gill. But his character bears no other resemblance to Eric Gill except being over-attached to his daughters.
And the potter angle?
The pots I invented. I did a lot of research. I am descended from potters. I am descended from working-class potters like Philip's parents, who come from what Arnold Bennett called the Five Towns in the middle of England, where there are all these high chimneys and pots are made. I've had many letters telling me that there were not the Five Towns, there were Six Towns. So I shouldn't say it, but that's what Arnold Bennett said. Philip's myself, in a way. Olive isn't. But Philip is a person totally obsessed with making an object. And he has run away from his family and come to London. He's seen a beautiful pot, and he wants to make one himself.
And when we're talking pots, we're talking beautiful, gorgeous urns?
Well, we're talking everything, really. We're talking beautiful cups and saucers. We're talking mad sculptures. There were some people called the Martin Brothers who made grotesque, awful-looking birds that you could take the heads off, and which now go for sort of tens of thousands of pounds if you can find one. You see them on the Antiques Roadshow from time to time. We're talking the whole arts and crafts movement as well, because they believed in going back to the earth and making good, solid, honest earthenware. They hated bone china. They thought there was something wicked about porcelain, which I find rather comical.
Over the course of the book, certainly artistic trends shift and change. I mean, that's part of life, and what was silly last year is not silly today and will be silly tomorrow. I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely, that is what happens. I was given some assistance by a wonderful living potter who has just written a wonderful book, and he does very elegant porcelain cylindrical pots, and he allowed me to put my hands inside some clay on his wheel and turn the wheel, and this pot sort of rose up and then flopped over sideways, as pots do all of a sudden, and I was very abashed. But he told me a great deal of the history of it, and I learnt from him also. I'd always seen pottery as a rather peaceful art. You know, you sit there with clay, which is a peaceful... It isn't at all. It's all made in kilns and furnaces, which have to be burning very, very violently at a very high temperature. If the temperature's wrong, you lose 3 years' work in 10 minutes. And you can either blow the whole lot up or they sink into a ghastly mess.
I notice as the book progresses, your interests begin to take over. And so we learn all about women's suffrage from the period. There's an entire sequence taking place in the 1900 Paris Exposition. We learn all about puppetry. The character of Stern, the puppeteer, is he based on someone? Are those plays based on real plays?
Some are, some aren't. There is a Viennese puppeteer of the period called Teschner, whose wonderful, extraordinary figures are in the major museum in Vienna, which somebody took me to see. And I went to the Munich Puppet Museum, and I read The Lives of the Puppeteers, and I should sing the praises for the moment of the Internet. A novelist like me can now get, in all sorts of languages, information about all sorts of subjects. And so I had hundreds of books on puppets. And so you could run sort of 5 or 6 people together and make a new person. I wrote the plays myself because I am a writer.
And you wrote Olive's stories, of course, as well.
And I wrote Olive's stories.
Olive's stories are quite long and quite incomplete. They're digressions that I wondered about putting them in the book entirely. I mean, I got caught up and suddenly they stop.
One of them is one that I tried to write. I don't write stories for my grandchildren, but I tried many, many years ago to write a story for my granddaughter. And I didn't know how to end it. And I thought, well, I can put it in the book, because in the book I don't have to end it. It's part of the book. And the other one, the very long one, Tom Underground, which is like a kind of thread of underground fear and violence and mystery and magic running through all the sort of surface of the events people's ordinary lives. That one, in a sense, was always going to be endless. It was like one of those endless long worms that you never reach the tip of the tail.
In some various convoluted forms, it continues throughout the book, even to the point where the puppet show that Olive works on toward the end of the book has elements of Tom Underground.
Yes, she takes Tom's stories. Her idea is that she writes a little private story, beautifully decorated, for each of her many children. And Tom, being the eldest, has the best story and is the one who really cares about his story. She turns it into a stage play, which is hugely successful, which I think is not very like Peter Pan. In fact, it's not really like Peter Pan at all, but it couldn't have been invented by me if Peter Pan hadn't already existed. I took a lot of stuff again from the Germans, and it's a more grown-up fairy story play, apparently, than Peter Pan.
Well, it's much darker.
And much darker. And even the staging I invented a bit. It uses puppets in a different way from the way Peter Pan does. I enjoyed reading about the stage machinery in Peter Pan. It all is part of one work of art, I feel I should say. We're sort of taking it apart into little themes and things. Everything is interlaced like a tapestry or a bit of crocheting. All the threads meet the other threads.
And some are metaphors for different things that occur within the context of the book.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about the broader aspects of this book, A.S. Byatt, then. Let's start with the name, The Children's Book.
I had a running title that wasn't that, which was more like the title of a children's book. It was called The Hedgehog, The White Goose, and The Mad March Hare at one point. And then I realized nobody would pick up the references to little English books in that, and I just suddenly saw it had to be called The Children's Book. It was a society in which grown-ups wanted to be children. They wanted to go on picnics. They wanted to run wild in the woods. They stomped endlessly over the landscape, sort of eating sandwiches. And as people keep pointing out, you know, gentlemen in London rushed into gentlemen's clubs in order to eat nursery food. They ate the sort of horrible steamed puddings they had as little boys at school, comfort food. And they were rather playful. They liked jokes, and they liked what Kenneth Graham called messing about in boats and fishing and things like that. They would remark this of themselves. I think one of the things they used to say was that they were released from the constricting presence of Queen Victoria and her great grief. And she was an old woman mourning a man who had been dead for a very long time. And when she died, the new king was a womanizer, not very young either. They didn't know quite what to do. They felt all released. They started playing games and telling each other stories.
It seems then that, you know, if you were going to look upon a particular person or image from the time, which kind of is emblematic, it would have to be Peter Pan.
Absolutely. And Peter Pan got the whole feeling of that period. Iris Murdoch always used to say, you know, it is the masterpiece of our time. And I don't think he knew what he was doing exactly, but it is a terrifying work. I mean, the title is Peter Pan or The Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up. And Barry, of course, was a boy who wouldn't grow up and was divorced by his wife after, you know, several years of marriage for non-consummation of the marriage. He was terribly happy when playing with other children. I don't think he was a paedophile at all. I think he wanted to be a boy, and he wanted to play with other boys. And his own child had been really quite difficult, and his brother had died at the age of 14, just like that, in a skating accident. And Barry was unable to replace this boy in his mother's affections. And so he sort of went out into the world of adopting children and writing for children and writing about children. Quite a lot of his stories, as opposed to the play Peter Pan, are really sinister. And I don't think he knew it.
There seems to have been some crossover of Wizard of Oz from America.
Absolutely. Wizard of Oz is very, very interesting in that context because it's the same moving into another world where you see everything through emerald green spectacles and you march through endless woods full of both danger and comfort with strange creatures. It just suddenly all happened. And they rediscovered the old fairy stories. There was the wonderful Andrew Lang who produced the coloured fairy story books, the crimson, the purple, the yellow, the green. I have written an introduction to the pink fairy story book. The grown-up literature is rather irritating. I still don't like H.G. Wells, and I grew up as a student in a world in which the great writer was D.H. Lawrence. And I now find him quite difficult to read because I find both of them very strident. They have this kind of political preaching noise, whereas the children's books, A, there is danger, and B, there is play.
A.S. Byatt, in terms of the children's book, we've also got the Fabian Society of, you know, almost a childlike innocence in assuming you could change the world.
Absolutely.
And you've also got, at the same time, the theosophists and the seances as well.
And Mary Stopes, who is an amazing character and was joined the theosophists and invented birth control. They really thought they could make a new world, a better world. My imagination is so unhistorical. I did quite a lot of thinking about this admirable innocence in many ways, because although they were not going to change human nature, they did change the circumstances of quite a lot of poor people.
Particularly afterward. I mean, the entire society that we have, the safety net, which of course is always going to be under attack, but that safety net exists because of these people's theoretical thoughts.
Absolutely. And the generation before them doing the research and finding that I think it was 60% of the poor in the East End didn't have enough money to subsist. They were below the starvation line. They found this out and they went and did something. This was admirable. But as I say, they were rather pleased with themselves.
When I'm talking to a friend of mine, he made a comment about what he saw as one of the themes, which was artistic accomplishment and dedication to high ideals does nothing to affect the relentlessness of the real world.
This is something I have always known and always believed. I think the thing I care about most in the world is making. I always think of making an object when I think of writing a book. It doesn't change anything. And I say to people, when thinking about really wonderful novels, if you really want to change the world, you go out and be a good journalist. That will help more. Art is wonderful, and if you happen to be able to do it and you happen to be able to make a good work of art, then you can live in a state of dreadful overexcitement and happiness.
On the other hand, I don't want to get too far into that, people like George Lakoff here in Berkeley have said that, in fact, it's art that changes the world because our opinions aren't formed by someone convincing us. They're formed by changes in the framework of how we view the world, and it's art that changes the framework. It's not my haranguing you to get you to believe something.
I think it's much more than art, and I think in our time, if you think about the media by which we're surrounded, most of the media isn't art. It's anti-art. It's sort of un-art. People watch endless narratives, which are in many ways very artfully produced.
Well, but it's coming in through the back door, whether it's great art or kitsch.
Yes, or kitsch. And we have to decide between great art and kitsch. I'm not sure. I think people want to believe that great art changes the world. I know great art has changed me. And every time I hit another great work of art, I am changed again. And this is a kind of, as I say, overexcited state to be in. Some artists have educated the world. One of the ironies of being in the United States is that the only book I am quite sure changed the world was Uncle Tom's Cabin, the only novel. Because most of Dickens's novels were written after the events that he was complaining about had already been changed. He was reporting on something that had gone. But she was there, as President Lincoln told her. But you won't find many people who will acknowledge either that she did any good or that the book is any good. I mean, the book is like a battering ram, and it's so strong that whatever its faults, it is an absolute masterpiece. You can't get anyone to admit it. Not here, or indeed to read it, I think.
I haven't asked a writer this in a while, but it's something that I always found interesting when I did ask the question, which is, as a writer gets totally involved in the book, in various ways, their life starts resembling the book that they're writing in almost mysterious ways. Does that happen to you?
I don't think this one did. The thing that did happen to me, which is part perhaps of what you're saying, was that I understood for the first time where my parents came from. My father was a member of the Fabian Society. My mother was descended from working-class potters. And as I began to see who my parents were, I began to see who I was. And this went alongside the novel. I have no intention of writing an autobiography, so, and this book has almost nothing of me, I think, in any of the people, and I enjoy it for that reason. I dislike both the word and the idea of self-expression. I think you shouldn't express yourself. You should look out at the world and see what else is there. The trouble was, it was very hard with this thing to stop looking, because there was always another thing just over the next street, over the next horizon to be looked at.
Was there ever a time when you felt like things might get a little bit out of control, that it could just expand into the world? I mean, you had to keep it down to England, some scenes in Germany, and that one section in France. But it could just go on forever.
It could have gone on forever. What I wanted to do was make a microcosm. I wanted to make, as it were, a world that you could hold in your hands, which had in it everything possible out of the real world that could be got into it. As you get older, as I get older, I'm not so interested in ordinary people's ordinary relationships, which resemble each other. I'm interested in the way the whole of humanity, and indeed inhuman things like asparagus and tree frogs, fit together or don't fit together. I've got a highly constructive mind, and all the bits that are in the book, as I see it, artistically part of all the other bits. There isn't anything in there that I feel got terribly out of hand. I got lectured for having put in, for instance, the exams that Dorothy had to take. She's the character that wanted to be a doctor. But I was very shocked when I read. I mean, she would, in fact, have had to give up 5 or 6 years of her life. She would not have had time to have human relationships if she was going to be a woman and a doctor. And I thought the reader might like to see just what terrifying exams this poor girl had to sit. And some of the readers get annoyed because they just want to know what she felt. And some of them feel like me, my God, this is really interesting.
There were times when I got completely lost in who was dating who, because there's so much of that. I guess you must have had a chart at one point, because you had to keep several characters going through different periods of time when there's also the history going on, and then there's the placement of the characters in specific places and their relationships, both overt and covert.
It was difficult. It was very difficult. I had two chronologies on the computer. One was a real chronology, and one was a fictive chronology, and they started in 1895 and ended in 1919. And in the real chronology, I put in odd things like the date of Queen Victoria's death, but more I put in precise movements among the curators at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and when certain things were published and when certain people said something. So I got a kind of linear sense of the period. And then I did a fictive chronology about who went to bed with who, you know, in what year, in what place, and who got seduced in Newnham College, Cambridge, as Henry H.G. Wells actually did seduce one of the young Fabians in Newnham College. I got all that in. And then my husband created for me an Excel. And along the top, I had the names of all the characters. And I put what age they were in 1895 in the top line. And then I just went down 1896, 1890, and put what age they were. So at any given moment I could look across this. And I will tell you that one of the characters is missing a year. I won't tell you which on air. This was picked up by the proofreader, and she thought it could be solved by making this character just changing the dates. And in fact, doing that would have unraveled the whole novel. It would have been like taking a pair of scissors to a piece of knitting. Added to which, this person, the proofreader wanted her to be 11, and she was actually, in my novel, 13. Well, she couldn't suddenly go back to being 11 because she wouldn't have been feeling the right emotions or anything. I did a bit of sort of shifting. And at one point, I had made somebody's pregnancy about 8 months too long. That was picked up, again, by this really wonderful proofreader, who again thought it was perfectly simple simply to change it and didn't realise what it did to everything else in the book. Nobody's picked either of those things up since.
The only character whose age I began questioning was the character of Hedda.
Dead on, dead on. Hedda has got a year missing, and it's rather like the mistake William Golding made in Lord of the Flies, which turns on Piggy's glasses being stolen to start fires with, and the thing that was wrong with his eyes means he wouldn't have had the sort of glasses that you could start a fire with. It's, you know, how much, this is a question people keep asking, how much does it matter if you make a mistake like that?
Well, of course, there's the famous story in, I think it's The Big Sleep, who killed the chauffeur? Somebody asked after the book was published, well, who killed the chauffeur? And Chandler looked and went, I don't know.
I love Chandler. I just bought a Kindle. I knew there was something I wanted to put on it, and it's him.
When I was done with my notes, I drew up a list of just kind of questions, and we obviously don't have time for them, because there are so many areas that each one that you delve into, the sexual life of public schools in England, abortion, birth control, of which there isn't any, apparently.
No, Emma Goldman was giving covert lectures on birth control in Paris in 1900 at the time of the Great Exposition. And she was earning her money by taking American tourists round the naked statues. And then American tourists said these people should have fig leaves on. And Emma Goldman went round looking as neat as anything and then went and cooked anarchist lunches in her hotel. You know, it was terribly daring to give lectures on contraception, but about six people came.
One thing I did notice is that there's very little of class consciousness in there. They're all apparently middle or upper class, except for Elsie and Philip.
And Olive.
And Olive, that's right. Olive came from miners, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. But by the time the book begins, Olive has already made the transition, and her sister made the transition into the middle/upper-class life. There's very little of this class issue, except when it comes to Philip's sister, Elsie. And Philip himself, who as an artist almost transcends class. And I noticed nothing in the way of the whole idea of upstairs, downstairs.
I think the English have been obsessed by upstairs, downstairs. And what I say in answer to this question is, look at the great writers of the period. You have H.G. Wells, you have D.H. Lawrence. They went everywhere. Everybody loved them. Or didn't in the case of Lawrence. One was a miner's son, the other was the son of a housekeeper and a draper. The limits of class were much more porous than most novelists have said, and I wanted to show that, really. I wanted to show that it's quite easy to make the shift unless you're starving, in which case, you know, you can't get out to make the shift, or unless you're very upper class and are surrounded by servants. And those people don't interest me so. I mean, the upper classes at that period are sort of terrifying. I read quite a lot of writing about the ones who became the officers in the war. I read a brilliant life of Julian Grenfell, who went into the trenches writing how glorious this was, you know, like leaping into the light. But he was bored out of his mind as a young man in the upper classes. And it's these sort of upper, lower class, lower middle class people who have got something to do with themselves that interest me.
It wasn't that surprising that the upper-class people would accept Elsie. She had a problem with it, but they didn't.
That was the war, to be fair. I think they would not have accepted her if there hadn't been a war. The wife of the upper-class person was German, so she had been ostracized and spat at and not spoken to and not invited to things. And this happened to any German. There were a lot of Germans in England at the time, particularly in the financial world, and their invitations just dried up. And so she knew what it was to be unaccepted, this German lady. And she thought what she had was the widow of her son, who she thought was dead. And she was a good woman. And her husband, although a banker, was a good man and had had a sort of liberal English upbringing and been taught to think about charity anyway. So they thought, you know, here is this woman, and here is our grandchild, and we will do our best. And I think they would have done that. There are people who wouldn't have. They almost caricature themselves.
It seems, as I'm listening to you talk, that on some level you fell in love with all your characters.
I did a bit, because, as I say, they're nothing to do with me. They're just people who rose up out of the sort of field of me having sown all these seeds.
Well, aside from Prosper Kane, who you've talked about, the man from the museum, was there any other character that kind of was going to be just passing through the night and instead became a major character?
I think Elsie, whom we've just been talking about, Philip's working class sister, who ends up being an unpaid servant for Benedict Flood the Potter. I always thought she might get seduced, because one of the things that always happened if you had a commune of artists was that there was a predator who seduced everybody at this period. So in a sense, she began as somebody who might get seduced. And then I got worried about her feet, because her shoes didn't fit and she had to do all this work. And there was a scene I wrote where she sat down and said to the son of the potter, my feet are killing me, literally. And she was very bright, I realised. She was quite as bright as her brother, though not as single-mindedly gifted. And she was intelligent and she was articulate. She didn't get into a rage of anger. She got into a sort of steady, I will get somewhere with myself flow of anger. And the other thing that rather pleased me about Elsie was that when she got into trouble, the nice ladies of the neighbourhood, instead of sending her to a home for depraved girls, said, you know, our principles won't allow us to do that. We're meant to be forward-looking socialists and theosophists. And they gathered round and made a life for her. And I was rather pleased with that, too, because in a conventional novel, in a novel, for instance, by Edith Wharton, she would have become somebody nobody spoke to. I know there were a lot of women whom people did, in fact, speak to. Arrangements were made for people. And it was quite fun inventing what arrangements.
A.S. Byatt, are you planning to return to these characters?
No, I'm not. I'm moving on to another period I've not written about. I'm writing a novel about surrealists and psychoanalysts. And these are quite different kinds of people.
And is that also taking place in England and France as well?
England and France and Germany, I think. Because I have fallen in love for the first time with a dead person. I've fallen in love with Max Ernst. But I don't want to write about Max Ernst, so I've got to go through being in love with him and then invent a character that isn't Max Ernst. The symmetry is that what we will inevitably hit is the beginning of World War II.
And we're right back to where we started.
Exactly. We're going on the same kind of circle. It starts all idyllic with people living in little communities and making surrealist art and doing terrible, jokey things, and it ends. And Max Ernst was interned in France as an enemy alien and got out to the United States by Peggy Guggenheim. I think I might do my first bit of writing about the United States, because there was this little group of surrealists and psychoanalysts who emigrated here because of the war. I've always been afraid of writing about the States, because I know how likely I am to get it slightly wrong. I can write French people, German people. I can't do the voice yet.
You've been listening to an interview with A.S. Byatt, whose latest novel is The Children's Book, now out in trade paperback. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.